morning, rise into the street. Throw me on that necktie, strap wingtips on my feet. Got to find a reason, reason she was wrong. Got to find a reason, the client's money's all gone.
Wow, so that's the first time I'm hearing that rendition of Sublime's My Money's All Gone. It's by my twin brother, Brad. His voice is terrible. I guess twins don't share that angelic voice in common. But so we have our two guests today. Adam Krause is joining us from Kansas City today. And we have Jen Fiore, who's joining us from the Bay Area up in San Francisco. And thanks for coming on. Today we're talking about sex abuse cases, the Boy Scout cases that are going across nationwide right now, which Adam's firm has tens of thousands or something crazy. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. But Jen, I want to start with you coming to us from the Bay Area. First of all, congratulations being married 20 years from the social media stalking. I found that out about you. And also you have a 16-year-old daughter learning to drive during COVID. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's been interesting with COVID and the DMV. Every time she's had a test set up to like take her permit and then to drive, the DMV has closed. But she's keeping her spirits up and having fun driving us around. And I look forward to when she can officially be our designated driver.
And so you are known in, you know, our industry and send you referrals for my firm for sex abuse cases. And you've published in that arena. You know, you were also awarded Public Justice Foundation's Trial Lawyer of the Year in 2014. Can you tell our listeners and viewers a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The Public Justice Award was for the lead paint litigation that was brought on behalf of 10 cities and counties throughout California. And Mary Alexander, whom I worked with for many years, she was involved since the very beginning. So this litigation took 20 years. And then there was a bench trial and a favorable result and then subsequent resolution. So the Public Justice Organization recognized the amount of effort that went into that case and set some precedent nationwide.
Yeah, so 20 years, that's a lot of time to get paid perhaps and not per hour, right? And it's getting, you know, talking about getting paid perhaps. So you started your own firm in 2019 with your partner, Sophie Ackerman, the FA law firm. And so tell us a little about that formation, how it came to be and what you specialize in.
So Sophie and I started our firm in the beginning of January 2019. We worked together for over 10 years at Mary Alexander & Associates. And we just decided it was time to do our own thing, start our own practice. And just as an example of having the freedom to do what we want, last fall, I was able to settle a sex abuse case for a nominal amount. But we got the perpetrator off the street, so to speak. He was a massage therapist. He can't practice anymore. And he's now paying my client over 9 years. So he has to think about what he did wrong every time. And so that's just an example of how I feel like being in control of my own practice lets me do things like that.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, standard of care, holding persons and corporations accountable, because it's a little tricky for our listeners that don't understand that area of law. So I'm going to pivot real quick. We're going to go over to Adam joining us from Kansas City. So Adam, first of all, are you drinking any bourbon or having any barbecue right now?
Ooh, I will be having barbecue in about 30 minutes from now. I mean, it is almost a religion here. And keep this as an open invitation for anyone that's actually listening to this. Give me a call anytime. I'll, at a minimum, direct you to the right barbecue. And if anything, if I'm not doing anything, I'll join you. So, absolutely.
And talking about things happening during COVID, you, like I, had a child during COVID. Yours is, what, September 1st, Kennedy came into the world joining Callahan. So what's it like having a two-year-old and a newborn during these times?
Well, I could hear what, I don't know if you guys, I could hear one of them downstairs right now. I'm working at home today, for the pandemic, but yeah, I will say it, I don't know if I'm sure you share this as well too, is that part of it's kind of cool because I've been spending so much more time at home than I haven't been going into the office as much. And so going downstairs even to get a cup of coffee is pretty cool because I get to see both of them and then I, you know, go back upstairs to the office. So there are positives, to it, but also, the same token, you want to be able to hand your baby to everyone around, and you can't really do that right now. So, but it's a cool time, but there's some, you know, some challenges too.
So, what's it like? I mean, you're operating, I think your firm represents some 20,000 plaintiffs right now, right? I mean, how are you able to do that from home in this virtual world?
Yeah, so across all of our litigations, we represent more than 20,000 plaintiffs, and that could be in pharmaceutical cases, it could be sexual abuse cases, or otherwise. We have some other litigations that we're working on. It's all technology. What we try to do is every meeting that we have, we do it face-to-face via Zoom. I think a lot of things can get lost if you're just going to call people up on a telephone. So we've made it nearly a standard rule in our firm. If we're going to have a conversation, it should be on Zoom. It should be on FaceTime or something like that, because then you feel connected. I think that is extremely important. We do a Tuesday morning meeting with our entire firm. This is everyone. And that's all done via Zoom. And then everyone shares a, you know, kind of a challenge that they're having for the week. We help each other with it. And then also just a fun fact about themselves. And I think that kind of camaraderie really helps doing it in person. It's like you're having an in-person meeting, and we made that generally a rule from the beginning.
Yeah, and I mean, you just started your firm some 5 years ago, and up to 20,000 clients doing this virtual. So did you start your firm with a virtual mindset, put these solutions in place? Because you do a lot of nationwide cases. I mean, friends, how many Boy Scout abuse cases do you have at your firm?
We have nearly 7,000 Boy Scout cases.
Wow. And you're able to do a lot of that even during the pandemic virtually?
We signed up and we represented every Boy Scout case during the pandemic. So before the pandemic, we didn't have a single Boy Scout case in our firm.
Wow. And
so we signed them up, retained them, interviewed them. During the process, we needed to have the claim form in. I hired more than 75 people. All 75 of those folks that we ended up hiring were social workers with social working background, either a degree in social working or some type of child sexual abuse. So we set up the process. All of this was done virtually. In fact, never met a single one of those 75 people in person.
Wow. And are they, I mean, that's just incredible what you're able to pivot and do in a short amount of time. So just a little background on Adam. So anybody that's a Matthew Broderick fan, he was actually bit by the monkey Virgil that was on Project X. Is that why you're looking a little flushed? You still have those?
That is a true story. Yes, there's something in me, I swear. But that is a true story. Showing, if you come and have barbecue with me, I'll still show you the scar that I have from this monkey that bit my foot. I ended up having stitches from it. And that's why I wanted to become a personal injury lawyer.
After that you went and majored in biology at KU, and then you went to go work in pharmaceuticals. I mean, and now you're suing pharmaceutical companies. What's up with that?
That's it. I learned the tricks while working inside all the nefarious things that they were doing seemed apt for me to become a lawyer and teach them a lesson.
All right. So, Jen, I'm going to shift a little topic here. You wrote and or published an article about child sex abuse cases and the standard of care and how to cut through those things. So a lot of times we're handling cases as lawyers where the perpetrator is uninsured. They don't have the money to compensate the victim for the harms done. So can you kind of walk our listeners through what they have to do and prove to kind of be able to compensate our clients for whenever they're sexually abused?
For sure. It depends on the organization. If you're suing school districts or universities that are publicly owned, a lot of times you'll find that there are rules and regulations, the mandatory duty to supervise, for example, of an elementary school children. So you want to make sure you understand that there's certain laws that apply to public entities versus non-public entities. And with any negligence case in California, you need to prove notice for a non-public entity. I mean, you also need notice in some sense when you're suing school districts for sex abuse or bullying or assault, what have you. But in terms of notice, it's not that hard because there's usually red flags. And there's red flags of inappropriate conduct. And you have to show that there was a tendency of this person to behave inappropriately. You don't have to necessarily show that there was the exact same sexual assault that had occurred previously in these cases.
So walk us down the path first. Say you have a public entity, say this is an elementary school, public university. You said there is this mandatory duty to supervise. Can you explain how, let's talk just about public cases first. How that works, how it pertains to cases, how you prove notice, and just walk our listeners through that.
Sure. In terms of the process, serving discovery, taking depositions, looking, starting with your fundamental facts, and then the investigation that occurred. And most of the time, it's reported. Sometimes it's not. And that's another situation where then you have to, your lawsuit is the first incident or report. But one thing to keep in mind with public entities is that there's no requirement for sexual abuse that you bring a government tort claim ahead of time. So California allows victims to basically seek redress without having to file the government tort claim ahead of time. And
yeah, so how does that work? So I say when you have a young child that was sexually assaulted by their special needs teacher and you don't have any evidence of this happening at a public school with this person prior to this, do you have to file a government claim? Can you file a lawsuit? What do you have to prove? Do you have to prove notice? How does that work?
So if you have a situation where there's a teacher that doesn't have a documented history, it's best to do your investigation. And the best place to start is your own parents and what they know. And the child usually comes home, even with special needs, and their behavior changes, where they are more withdrawn, where they're crying, where they're screaming when their parents taking them to school. So parents start to sense that something's wrong. There's usually aides in the classroom or other parents that have noticed inappropriate things. So you just got to talk to people to build the notice if there's no prior complaint. But again, there's the duty to supervise in the public school setting. So if
yeah, so tell us about that. What is the duty to supervise? How does that play out? And is it the same as public versus private?
Well, in terms of private, it's the negligent standard of care in terms of what a reasonable other school would be doing to supervise. But in the public school setting, you can't just let an autistic child go to the bathroom by themselves or go into the bathroom with an adult. There are rules in place that where abuse can occur because it's behind closed doors or it's around the corner in a portable, there is a duty to always supervise the children, even on recess and throughout the school premises. So that's where I really have, over the last few years, pled mandatory duties under Government Code 815.6 for failure to supervise, because you always got to know where the children is, child is, and you always have to know where the adults are too.
Yeah, so then can you prove, I mean, can you file a lawsuit for a listener? Can they file a claim or a lawsuit without proving notice, or can you do that during the pendency of the litigation?
That's a good question. I strongly believe we have a reasonable duty to know that there was abuse before we file and believe our client. But most of the time you're proving, you're getting all the facts that really back you up after you've filed.
And let's talk about treasure troves, and I'll ask Adam the same question. So when you're looking to prove notice and looking for things outside of discovery, things that you can ask in discovery and they may or may not give you, where are you looking? You mentioned parents, teachers, aides, but when you're prosecuting these cases, you hire investigators. What are you looking for and where are you looking?
Yeah, I think in our child sexual abuse cases, for that matter, and I could just think of a couple off the top of my head. Obviously, you're going to want a subpoena or at least send a preservation letter for the videotapes inside the school or inside the actual premises. You know, one of the things that we do, too, is if a child was abused in a daycare or at a school or wherever it might be, talking to the other kids' parents is a really good idea, too, because they might key off on. We had a tragic case that was near a playground, and every time one of the teachers would take the kids away from the playground. And other kids were like, oh yeah, they always take me to the special playground. And so if you could talk to some of the other parents, they could really key you in on maybe what actually might be happening when the student or kid or daycare, you may not be able to get the full set of facts, but if you talk to some of the other parents, or if you talk to some of the other kids as well too, if the parents allow you to, that's a really good avenue of discovery. Jen, I don't know if that works in your cases, but we interview them a lot.
Absolutely. it's what other people know in these cases, particularly with elementary school kids or special needs kids who can't speak for themselves and articulate exactly what happened.
I mean, and do you ever do social media dives? I mean, what are some other things other than talking to the parents that you do to try to prove that this school knew or should have known about these things?
Yeah, full on board. Social media dives is a really good idea to do. I mean, you're going to find a lot of things on social media, and even, you know, so especially if you have some investigators that are really savvy on social media, you can find some really good things out. You know, one of the things that we look at too in discovery, and I'm in Kansas City, so my local cases here, a lot of things what we do is we look at understaffing and things like that. How could this have actually happened? So specifically in daycares, a lot of times you'll find that there's way too many kids that are there and they're way understaffed. They may say there's, you know, one staff member for every 5 kids, and you're going to find that there's one staff member for every 10 kids when you actually start looking at who's signing in and getting paid for that day. And so we do a lot of discovery to determine if there's actually proper supervision at the facilities. Not as much in school cases, but in daycare cases or those types of cases, we do a lot of discovery just to find out who's clocking in and who's clocking out.
And what ratio, Jen, when we're looking at ratios for supervision at a daycare or something like that, is there a general rule or set rule we're looking for? 1 to 5, 10 to 1, 100 to 1?
There are definite ratios set by the state of California from the daycare level, even with children and their individual education plans and how many aides are needed. So that is always useful to know what the standard is and to go after where they're not meeting that standard.
And what are some other areas when you're pleading a case for negligence, when you're trying to hold the school or the corporation accountable? What are the different theories? We talked about the not enough having enough people, the duty to supervise, perhaps knowing about the dangerous propensities of this person if you did some your due diligence. Are there any other avenues that you pursue when you prosecute these sex abuse cases, trying to hold the corporation or schools accountable?
We pursue premises liability as well as dangerous condition of property when appropriate. Like the example I gave earlier of the one portable being in a particular area of the campus where they didn't have any video surveillance. Mm-hmm. So premises liability puts a whole nother layer of duty, even though, you know, it's a negligent principle, but it puts a whole nother layer that helps in terms of insurance. It helps with also just meeting your burden of proof overall.
Yeah, I'll throw in another idea, and this would be rare in California because it's such a big state, but where I live in Missouri and Kansas, you know, I live in Kansas, I work in Missouri, so we cross state lines quite frequently. Mm-hmm. And so if some of these events happen when you cross state line, there are sex trafficking laws that are unbelievably powerful, and those could be looked at. So in California, if you had a case where someone, say you're going to go to a nearby state and you're going to cross state line, those are things to look at as well too, because there's liquidated damages clauses, there's attorney clauses for fees, for costs, expenses. So if you have like a school trip and something happens on a school trip when they're going to go visit the White House or something like that, start looking creatively with some of these laws, because they're very powerful. It would be infrequent. You wouldn't want to bring them in a state court, but they're really good laws.
And would this always put you in federal court if you're raising the sex trafficking? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
And so can you give your contact information for our people that aren't watching, because we'll have a graphic with it, but can you just tell our listeners so they can hear it first, Adam, and then we'll go to Jen?
Yeah, so I'm adam@krausenkinsman.com. And that's KrausenKinsman.com.
And I'm Jennifer at thefafirm.com. So it's the F for Fiore, A for Ackerman, firm.com.
Yeah. And, you know, I appreciate it. I've never heard the, you know, some of these other nuanced ways, the premise liability ones. And that's why I refer you those cases, Jen, right? And so thank you for paying attention to that one. So in the sex trafficking ones, that just fascinates me. You know, Adam, have you anything else you can give our listeners? Because just piquing interest in my head, you know, those school trips that when I grew up in Pittsburgh, they take us to Washington, D.C., these places. I never even thought about that as a lawyer being able to pursue something like that. Can you think of any other examples that you've done in your practice using that law, heard of that law being used effectively for our listeners?
Yeah, so I will say it's not being used effectively yet, but there's other ways to just start thinking about it where you might be able to be a bit creative. And I don't think the law is developed here yet, but if you look at some of the trafficking cases that are out there, when you're looking at like the back of the yellow pages or things like that, if it's being published in one area, right? So if it's being published in one area and it's there's a whole bunch of this in this special law, and I wish I could quote it right now what it actually is, but there's other information right there on child pornography and things like that as well too. And so in the actual damage clause is what's so interesting about it. Number one, the statute of limitations is quite favorable for folks that are coming out that are older than the age of 18. So there's a, it's based on the actual injury. And so there's a nice tolling period after the age of 18 in the statute as well too, but also a damages clause as well too. But if you look at the statute, where you could start seeing this is where you might be able to use it is when there are things online of pornography that's posted and cases like that. You might be able to use this statute, and it's extremely powerful. I mean, the damages are already set, I think, at a $150,000 minimum liquidated damages. I think that's right. And so just that's your base level. That's a minimum standard. And so take a look at it. And I think there's a lot of, it's only now just being used, especially with all the Epstein stuff that's happened. So I don't think it's been very frequently used before this, but I think it's an area of law that can grow and develop and be used by a lot of creative lawyers.
Yeah, and you brought up the statute of limitations, so we're going to talk a little bit about that. So, I mean, Adam, you're 7,000 plus cases of the Boy Scout case, and some of these cases, this wasn't 6 months ago or last year. I mean, we're talking about abuse decades long. We're living in worlds where I'm, prosecuting product cases and things like this that are 2-year statute limitations, sometimes 4 for fraud. Walk our listeners through how the statute of limitations applies. We get that call from a client talking about abuse that happened when they were 4 and they're now 40. How does this work?
Yeah, I'm sure, Jen, you could probably talk a little bit about the revival window, especially in California. I'll touch base it on a kind of granular level, and maybe you could take it to California, but I think what's happened, and this is going to happen more and more frequently across the country, is that we are going to have these revival windows for statute of limitations. And the reason is, and it goes all the way back to the Catholic priest cases, all this stuff was swept under the rug for decades. I mean, this is as I always say, this is an epidemic within a pandemic. There's no question about it. There it is. And you look at the number of Boy Scout cases, there's 90,000 cases, 90,000 survivors that came forward in the Boy Scouts. And if you look at the Catholic Church, you know, they probably had another 30,000 folks that couldn't come forward because it wasn't socially acceptable. It wasn't proper. You know, it's almost like a scarlet letter if you do come forward. And so the legislators in good states like California have decided that there needs to be a revival window so these voices can finally be heard. And that's what's happening in California. And I'll kick it to you, Jen, where you could talk a little bit more about actual California, because I think you're going to have a better grasp of me. But that's where it started. It started with the Catholic Church. Then you looked at the Olympics and things like that. And it's going to go state by state. I know it will. But Jen, maybe you could talk about Cali.
For sure. So one of the biggest thing that changed recently was not only giving the 3-year window, is giving victims up to age 40. To bring a claim for childhood sex abuse under CCP 340.16. So the 3-year window opened January 1, 2020. So victims still have until January 1, 2022 to bring a lawsuit, or maybe it's 2023. I have to do my math. I haven't done it. The 3-year window starts in January 1, 2020. So whenever that ends, all these victims can bring claims. There's a little hurdle. You have to have a licensed psychiatrist or psychologist evaluate the person before you file if you're in that 3-year window and you're over age 40. But that's usually not a huge hurdle to overcome. But our state has broadened the statutes in other ways as well, allowing sexual assault and battery victims when they're adults up to 10 years to bring a lawsuit. And there's just momentum that keeps changing. For example, the statute was modified for the USC cases. Now the statute was just modified again, effective January 1, 2021, for the victims of Dr. Heaps in UCLA to bring claims within a one-year window this year.
Wow. So I want to take a step back to not talk about law, but talk about the human perspective. How hard is it, Jen, I'm going to start with you. How hard is it when you get that phone call from someone to talk about something that happened 10, 20 years ago and actually get them to want to talk about it and not wear that fear, that scarlet letter?
Well, it's changed over time. I really think the Me Too movement has empowered victims to talk to a lawyer when they know it's confidential and tell their story. And most of the time, our practice is just to listen, ask facts along the way, but let them tell their story and then dig into where we think we need criteria to fit within the law.
Yeah, and Adam, how about you? I mean, screening some 9,000 of these cases, getting those calls, hiring 75 social workers to talk them through their story and talk them through the trauma. I mean, what do you do with that client that tells you this horrific story and says, but I don't want to know it's me. Like, can you file with a Jane Doe, a John Doe? I mean, how do you protect these people?
Yeah. So a couple things that I want to touch on there is that, first of all, that I think that this type of case is the hardest case to hear from one or folks that have not been able to talk about this for decades. Like, it may be, I represent people that are 80 years old and they haven't told their spouse. And so they want me to send mail to a special address and things like that to keep their privacy because they haven't told their spouse after 65 years. And so, and we do, we'll send it to a post office box or whatever they want us to do if we need to actually send mail to them. We do file under, you know, a Jane Doe or a John Doe to protect their privacy in these cases. One thing we typically try to do also on a practical level is we try to limit the depositions as well too. Unless the defense counsel is a complete jerk, they're going to limit the depositions to a time frame. This is at least my experience. I approach them and I say, look, you know, this is a tough case. You know, this is a tough case and you could drill this person for the next 6 hours or whatever, but I think it's better served if we could do a 2-hour deposition, allow for as many breaks as we possibly can for these guys, because, you know, these are really, really tough on them and they're going to come forward. They're going to do a great job. They're going to answer your questions, but let's limit it. And then there's one other thing I just want to say is that when you're investigating these cases, one thing is that always ask the person, because it's really good to bring these cases in teams, as I call it, as multiple plaintiffs. If there's one abuser, they will have abused, I think the FBI says, what is it, like 13 more people or something like that. One pedophile will abuse 13 people, and up to 50, I think, is what they say. And so oftentimes your client will know 2 or 3 or 5 or 7 more people that were abused. And that's a really good way to represent more folks, but also it's a really good way to build kind of a support system around there where they can come together against this establishment, this business, or whatever it might be.
Wow. I mean, it's just got to be so hard to have someone have to relive all of these emotions, these fears. Taking a quick pivot, have you ever found somebody to tell you a story or come up with a claim that you think was false?
Yes. I'm going to just say it. Yeah, of course we have. And
how do you know? What are the red flags?
Yeah, I'll give a couple red flags and then I want to give a caveat at the end of this as well too. A couple caveats. But when you start asking questions and if they don't know the answers, that's not a red flag. Especially for some of these older cases, if they don't know the person that abused them, the name, but they could say they were 5'11", you know, with red hair or something like that, that's enough for these cases. So they may not be able to tell you everything because these are a lot of times really repressed memories. But when their stories start to change a lot, those are the big red flags. When their stories start to change, especially on the Boy Scout cases, we needed to screen those out and make sure that their story was consistent, that they could provide a sufficient amount of detail for it to happen. We, of course, checked to see if they were in the Scouts at the time. If we could, sometimes they didn't keep records. But I also want to put a little bit of caveat on here is that of all these cases, especially in the Boy Scout cases, I had hundreds of people that were abused. There's no questions asked because they were crying on the phone. They were telling us about it. And they ultimately called their office back and said, look, we just can't go forward. We can't do it. We can't go through it. And so we sent them a disengagement letter. And so when people think of the number of being 90,000 or something like that, that number could have been 150,000. There's no question in my mind. So, you know, Jen could probably tell more red flags, but I think inconsistent stories is a big one, but definitely not a red flag to me is not remembering all the details. That's not a red flag to me.
I agree with that. One of the biggest red flags, and it's almost with any PI case, when the person starts talking about what they're going to get, how much money it's worth.
Yeah.
From the get-go. And I haven't represented people in the mass context for sex abuse. I mean, we represent multiple people who are victims of the same perpetrator. Exactly what Adam said. There's always your client, your person who first walks in is usually not the first victim. And sometimes the abuse spans decades. Even when you're representing a young boy who's been sexually abused, the perpetrator who's only 40 has been doing it for 20 plus years. Yeah. So
wow.
The other question
is, what's my case worth? And then can I take out a loan? Those are like the two bigger red flags for me across the board. Yeah, I need $5,000 a month. Wait, what are you talking about? So let's talk about experts for a minute. You know, when we're talking about whether the Boy Scout cases or the cases Jen's talking about, what type of experts do we have to hire for the standard of care? We know psychologists, things like this, but what about the standard of care? What do we look for?
We look for someone who has the experience in the industry, whether it's massage therapy abuse, whether it's a school in terms of supervision and administrator, in terms of I do want to add one thing, though, on the psychiatry psychologist side. Sometimes your clients don't tell you the full extent of what happened because they can't get it out. And so I had several times where when we send them to the expert psychiatrist, we learn how severe and pervasive it was in terms of quantity, nature. And so sometimes you're surprised, even in working with your experts, how bad it the situation really was.
Yeah. And Adam, we're in 2021 right now. And my understanding is that the time frame, the deadline in which to file the claims for the Boy Scout abuse cases have passed. Is that correct? So can you just walk our listeners through kind of the process going forward? I know it's active litigation. And I know it gets real ugly. And hopefully you're going to put a bulletproof windows in your house because they fight dirty for these big cases like this when there's billions at play. But walk us through how the process and the litigation is going to go in phases. Just let us know.
Sure. So all the cases needed to be into the bankruptcy courts. The Boy Scouts of America filed bankruptcy by November 16th. And so that's the effective bar date. That's when you had to have your claims in by. So now there's kind of a data processing center that basically there's a bunch of duplicate claims or things like that as well too. And you're finding out who the universe of folks that were abused, and we're learning their ages and where they're, what part of the country and all that. So from now, there are insurance companies at the table. They're the Boy Scouts of America that are at the table. There are the local councils that are at the table. And the way this works is it's a big pyramid. So you have the Boy Scouts, right? And so that's going to be the headquarters that was either in New Jersey or Texas, depending on what year it was. And then down from the pyramid, you had the local councils, and then you had the troops. At each level, there is money. And it could be insurance money. It could be property and assets. There's film out in New Mexico. There's sea bass and things like that that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And ultimately what will happen is they will either commit enough money and abusers will get paid, or there will be in all likelihood a post-litigation trust. And what that would look like is essentially a remand down to potentially state court. And we litigate these claims against local councils and or insurance companies and try to get these these survivors compensated.
And when you're getting these survivors compensated, is there the opportunity to take some of these claims, take them into the individual state courts and prosecute those claims individually? What Jen was talking about for premises liability, for supervision, you know, against the property owners or against the people that sponsored those Boy Scout trips, things like this.
Yes. The answer is yes. Especially it just really depends if the organization that you're going to go after are going to get what's called a channeling injunction. And I won't go into all that, but there are other entities that are going to need to contribute or be on the hook later on in state court, like you're talking about, like the Church of the Latter-day Saints, the Roman Catholic Church, the Methodist Church. All of these places played a huge part of scouting. In fact, there were special emblems. I was a scout, by the way. It was my part of my childhood. And I remember, you know, some of the classes and things like that they went through. There's the Roman Catholic Church emblem that people would wear when they went through enough of the tests and organization, like a merit badge. And so they were ingrained in the culture. And most of the meetings, many of the meetings happened at the Roman Catholic Church, at the Church of the Latter-day Saints. And so there could be spinoff litigation in that eventually as well, too, if they don't contribute enough money during the bankruptcy process.
Wow. And Jen, I'm going to ask you these questions. What do you think about the systematic, like if systematic abuse, you know, when we're talking about that, when you're prosecuting a case and it's, wow, I have one client, you investigation and you find it's a powder keg of information that you find. What are the next steps? Do you file individually? Do you file classes? What tips can you give our listeners?
Well, in terms of classes, I'll stay out of that. I've never been a class lawyer, even with multiple victims. So we just file individual suits or like a cluster action where we have multiple people on one lawsuit. The JCCP process in California works really well to have individual claims filed in a non-class context. For example, with the UCLA Dr. Heaps cases, there's a class case that was brought in federal court. Women have the option to opt out and then pursue separate litigation. And so there is litigation pending in LA County Superior Court, individual claims for all the victims. So we always pursue the individual route. That's just our area of practice. Whereas there's others that do bring class cases associated with sexual assault or abuse.
Well, you know, we're pretty much out of time. I think we went a little over, but you know, this, hope our listeners were educated. Any questions directly to us is media@justiceteam.com or me personally, robert@justiceteam.com. Again, Adam, is it adam@krausandkinsman.com?
Kinsman.com. Yep.
Yeah. Kraus and Kinsman. And it's jennifer@thefalawfirm.com.
No law.
Thefalawfirm.com. Good. Now everybody will not forget it. So everyone, thanks for coming on. Thanks for listening. I know it's a touchy-feely subject that not a lot of people talk about, but Jennifer's one of our stalwarts at Justice HQ, founding member of Northern California. She does a lot of the sex abuse cases that we work on together. She educates me just by me seeing the emails that go back and forth on the cases that we're associated together. And Adam, thank you for prosecuting a very important, you know, national matter of calling attention to these Boy Scout cases. And if you can send us off with maybe some parting words of wisdom or some things that you have found interesting that need to come to light during the litigation. I know it's, since it's pending, you can't say too much, but you know, anything would be very helpful for our listeners as a send off.
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, we're in mediation right now, but just know that the Boy Scouts isn't the only one. There are other organizations, and keep your eyes out for these cases, because we all need to, as plaintiff's lawyers, it's very important that we sniff these things out so they stop. I mean, this is truly, truly, when I say a pandemic, it is unbelievable. So keep your eyes open. That's what we all need to do. As plaintiff's lawyers, as you know, warriors for justice, these are things that we need to keep our eyes open, because obviously the rest of society hasn't.
Yeah. And everyone, thank you for listening for this edition of the Justice Team podcast. Reach out to our listeners directly for more candid and professional information. Mine will just be jokes and things like this if you hit me up. But everyone, thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning into this session.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Bob.
Early in the morning, rise into the street. Throw me on that necktie, strap wingtips on my feet. Got to find a reason, reason she was wrong. Got to find a reason, the client's money's all gone. Always on my iPad, always got Wi-Fi. I can play this jury like a motherfucking riot.